oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Check engine, ABS, or maintenance light on? Take the guesswork out of your warning lights with O'Reilly Veriscan. The service is free and provides a report with solutions verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we could recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
It's The Wonky Show. We talk student experience, tackling sexual harassment and hate crime, outward mobility, and what the next leader of the Conservatives thinks of HE. It's all coming up.
Got to work with experts outside the university. You've got to have people on site who are trained, who are supported, and you've got to make sure that staff in general, not just, you know, not just a handful of kind of champions, are really up to speed with the issue. So, I mean, when I spoke to women particularly for International Women's Day, working in this area.
To The Wonky Show, your direct way into higher education, policy, people and politics. I'm Rachel Firth, and here to trek over the glens of higher education policy as usual, we have three fabulous guests. In London, we have Gavin Conlon, partner at London Economics. Gavin, give us your highlight of the week, please.
So it's nothing higher education related. It's India turning over Australia in the Cricket World Cup.
And south of the river, we've got Greg Walker, Chief Executive of Million Plus. Greg.
Oh, I think it's probably the, again, nothing HE particularly, the spectacle of the Tory leadership contest and, 10 candidates doing launches within a space of 48 hours with Dutch Stroop waffles, gold wristbands and, you know, the theme tunes pumping out from Katy Perry and Justin Timberlake. It's been quite an interesting week, hasn't it? And journalists no doubt been running around with, like, headless chickens during this period.
Indeed, and my obsession with Matt Hancock grows stronger by the minute. And in Wonky HQ, that exists only in the cloud, we have Wonky's editor, Debbie McVitie. Debbie, give us your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight is definitely a braggy one, which is that yesterday, on a really lovely visit to Liverpool John Muir's Teaching and Learning Conference, I discovered that something I wrote 10 years ago about how to approach your PhD is still being read and used by PhD students today, which is humbling and also slightly disturbing.
10 years ago, you must have written that when you were doing your A-levels, Debbie. Good grief.
GCSEs, Rachel.
This week, we start with a student academic experience survey, which was produced by the Higher Education Policy Institute, or HEPI, and Advanced HE. Released this week, the annual survey is now in its 13th year, and it can measure like-for-like changes over that period. So, Gavin, what did this tell us this year?
Okay, so just before I hit the main findings, one thing about this survey is this is a really useful survey because, as you say, it hasn't changed for 13 years, or a lot of questions haven't changed. So it's actually a really good sort of... taking a pulse of the higher education sector. Also, the cover of this report is looks like a Bronski Beat album, so anybody in the 1980s will sort of appreciate that. Anyway, so 41% of students perceive good or very good value from their course. This is the second consecutive year with a 3 percentage point improvement. 29% of students perceive poor or very poor value from their course, which is a drop of 3 percentage points since last year and 5 percentage points since 2017. So value for money perceptions differ by the type of student. Students from Scotland have relatively high positive perceptions, while non-EU international students have relatively low positive perceptions. Recent funding changes in Wales have not yet had any material impact on first-year students there in terms of their value for money. Teaching quality is the main factor for students who perceive positive value for money, and tuition fees are the main factor for students who receive poor value for money, and that's about 62% in each case. Two-thirds of students would choose the same course at the same university if they're applying again, which is quite encouraging. Only 4% would opt to do an apprenticeship, and even fewer would not enter higher education to get a job. That's about 3%, or not enter higher education and do something else, which is only 2%. In terms of contact hours, there's been small changes to average contact hours and workload in recent years. So since 2015, there's been a decline in independent study. So about 15.2 hours declining to 13.8 hours a week. and an increase in timetable contact hours, so from 13.4 hours to about 13.9 hours. One other point relates to just general well-being and mental health. So students are significantly more anxious than other young people. So about 16% of students surveyed in the report felt low anxiety, against 37% for all those aged 20 to 24. One point here is it's a miracle that the folks who wrote the report could actually get any information from the ONS website about anything. So that's a major miracle. So the results also confirm that students want more support from taxpayers for the cost of teaching undergraduates. So 43% say the government should pay more or should pay over half the cost, and 22% say it should pay all the costs. But that's not really that surprising. It is out of line with the recent Augar report on the post-18 education in England, which says taxpayers should continue to pay half. So they're the main points. I just rattle them off.
Well, it's good to see a survey where things are going in the right direction. I mean, the indicators that Gavin's just summarised in terms of value for money and in terms of quality of teaching and assessment, I mean, show improvements now for a couple of years running. And, you know, we don't want to read too much into a two-year trend, but I think this is a really encouraging sign, and I think addresses some of the political debate and the media debate that's circulating around higher education. So a rare bit of good news, and that's a real positive. So I think I was smiling this morning or yesterday when reading the embargoed report. And this is important, I think, because some of the questions in this particular survey may well find their way into the next iteration of the National Student Survey. People suspect and people expect the OFS having taken control of the survey, albeit in line with the other three nations of the UK, perhaps to come to a compromise on what the questions will be. But people expect that there will be questions in future on value for money and more detailed questions about teaching intensity and so on. So this is a really crucial report, and it's good to see things moving in the right direction.
I think reading the survey, and I should sort of caveat my comments by saying, you know, this is a really substantial piece of work and asks some very important questions. But I couldn't help thinking that there was a window in policy world where the interests and concerns of HEPI as a kind of as a watcher of policy, and Advanced HE as a HEA as well as a sort of champion of excellent learning and teaching, were really, really closely aligned. You know, the era of the design of the TEF, before that, David Willetts championing learning and teaching and talking about things like contact hours. And now I sort of almost see, I'm beginning to see a sort of slight divergence. So the focus on things like student wellbeing and value for money, that's still very current in the policy landscape. But actually, the sort of things about sort of assessment and feedback and the more kind of detail of the learning and teaching experience and environment feel a bit off topic in some ways. And although those things are important in the round, they don't feel like necessarily part of the national policy conversation. So I think there's something about these sort of things sort of are beginning to sit sort of rather uneasily alongside each other for me. And the other thing that I thought was the way that the individual institutions are beginning to develop their thinking around what it is that they're offering, how they're differentiating themselves, actually the kind of the national, the sector-wide picture, or even that kind of sort of mission group or institution type comparison feels a bit rough. And I think, so I mean, and every survey is always a kind of snapshot in it, and it always starts further conversations. And I think that there will be some really useful conversations going on inside institutions as a result of this survey. But I'm not sure, for example, what comparing every post-92 institution in the sector tells me, because increasingly they are so different and they're trying to do different things.
I mean, I've actually spent a bit of time looking at the previous year's surveys as well, but, you know, really there's not many changes year on year. And I think you can't read too much into sort of a quick flip around in terms of whether more or less people think there's a change in value for money or perceptions of value for money. I think there are many positives in this report, but for instance, issues about two-thirds of respondents say that they wouldn't change their decision in terms of the university or the course that they were undertaking. It's also reassuring that you see about a third of students say that their expectations were not fulfilled, but that was because it was a lack of effort on their part. Okay, so people are sort of quite realistic about why expectations are met or otherwise. One of the things is that there's lots of chat about value for money, and that's a big sort of thing, and, you know, but I think the bigger issue relates to things like satisfaction and expectations. And satisfaction and expectations are sort of leading indicators of value for money, and they're driven by teaching. So a lot of the people who sort of say their expectations were met, it was because of teaching, good teaching. And a lot of people who said that their expectations were not met, it was because of teaching. So I think people are, you know, reading too much into the issues about fees and actually sort of veering away from issues about teaching quality. One other thing that nobody has mentioned is about all this stuff, all this material and lead tables. All this stuff about teaching is essentially unchanged over time. But when you see lead tables and people are, some institutions are jumping around 20 or 30 places, this really sort of makes you question about the reliability of lead tables and why we actually look at lead tables, because the fundamentals haven't changed. So why would individual organizations' rankings have changed to such an extent? It's really sort of, there's a dichotomy between the two.
And the small decline in the level of independent learning reported in the survey. Again, Gavin's right, we shouldn't read too much into 1 or 2 years' results as a trend. But I mean, that could be, you know, that is a real problem. I don't know whether it's pressures on people working while they're studying. This is an issue across institutions, as people will be aware. But that's quite closely correlated with academic success, the level of independent study, as Tim Blackman, the Vice Chancellor of Middlesex University, has reported in a couple of years ago.
Yeah, well, so that it's really is a leading indicator.
It does, yeah, absolutely. So that is a concern.
One other thing, and this is a sort of name call for Nick Hillman at Happy. I mean, essentially, there's other issues. I mean, these are a lot of correlations. I know we do this correlation thing later on, but a lot of the analysis here is just basically correlation. And there are real issues about the sample composition. So there's a reduction in the proportion of respondents who are arts and humanities, creative arts and history and philosophy and things. There's an increase in the proportion of the sample that are STEM graduates. So seeing changes in value for money might be driven from a compositional bias. I mean, this is wonky, so I'm giving you a bit of...
Well, I think there's also a disproportionate amount of students that are from an independent school background as well.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the sample representativeness, and I think some work has to be done on that, and I think you really got to get into the cross tabs and sort of beat the hell out of the data with some econometrics to actually sort of see what's driving what.
We because love you can see, getting in the cross.
And I mean, the other thing, of course, is to get into the alternative providers as well, and you know, so there was a small number that they were able to accumulate over 3 years. But I mean, if we're not going to, you know, if we're going to be able to kind of capture the experience of the whole sector, that's going to have to improve.
There was a talk earlier about the OFS getting involved or maybe taking over the survey. I mean, I think I don't think that's a great idea, because
I agree.
I've seen so many surveys that have been butchered because, you know, the policy choice of the time, you know, somebody is going to ask about a particular, you know, whatever it is, and then the continuity of the data gets destroyed. So, I mean, I'd be sort of strongly against that. If they want to run their own survey, fine, but this should just stay clean.
Okie dokie, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, my name is Paul Webb, and I'm a widening participation officer at King's College London. I've written a piece about the role of parental engagement in widening participation with reference to a programme we run at King's called Parent Power. And Parent Power is about helping parents in the local community become experts in access to higher education and also supporting them to campaign for change. I think the most important message in the article is about actually asking parents on a one-to-one basis what they are concerned about or what they need, and actually listening rather than assuming we know what's best for them as higher education people. So it's about building meaningful relationships and trust, and not just giving them a canvas to talking about grade requirements and expecting any kind of real impact. So I think it's time to go beyond just information, advice and guidance, and to really start designing quality tailored parental engagement programs for the communities that we serve.
Hi, I'm Johnny Rich. I'm the Chief Executive of the Engineering Professors Council and Chief Executive of Outreach Organisation PUSH. The Augur Review mentions the word value a lot, but it never defines it. From recent pronouncements, it's clear what the Education Secretary, Damien Hines, thinks value means. He thinks it means a degree that leads to a high salary. He recently said that any course whose students didn't start repaying their loans within 5 years was a poor value course. My piece that I've written for Wonky this week looks at all the ways that Damien Hines and the Augur's missing definition is wrong. Focusing on salaries is bad for enterprise, it's bad for the arts, it's bad for people who want to give more to society than they take, and it's bad for regional and social development. The problem is that value is a hard thing to define. And so, instead of value, we should look at our values. We should ask what matters to us and what education is for. We need to be clear about that in order to design a funding system that can deliver it.
Next up, the Office for Students, or OFS, has published an independent evaluation on tackling sexual harassment and hate crime in English universities. The evaluation carried out by Advanced HE looks at the impact of 108 projects awarded a total of £4.4 million to tackle hate crime and sexual violence and harassment at 84 universities and colleges. Debbie, would you be so kind as to set the scene on this one for us, please?
Thanks, Rachel. So this is in 2016, Universities UK published the Changing the Culture report, which was a sort of concerted effort to look at processes and best practice around tackling sexual harassment, sexual violence and hate crime in the higher education landscape. And following that, Hefke at the time put a fair amount of money into funding projects under the old Catalyst Fund. And Advanced HE has now carried out an evaluation of those projects. There were two rounds. One was focused on the sort of sexual violence harassment. The other was focused on the hate crime. And it's evaluating what the impact of that funding has been. And to some extent, and particularly if you read the OFS summary of the report, it's quite a good news story because unsurprisingly, the existence of funding really does kind of focus minds and activity. So you've got lots of partnership working with students in addressing these issues. You've got good partnerships with the community emerging. You've got the appointment of specialist staff, and you've got lots of projects that are raising awareness and vitally kind of increasing reporting. But as Jim Dickinson's written very well on the site, if you go into the Advanced HE report, which is much more reflective and much more dense, you find the real kind of meat of the evaluation. And there's clearly still some challenges around sustainability, which is what you always get with project funding, because when the money runs out, these projects don't always continue. Challenges around, in some cases, university leaders still feeling that there might be reputational damage by admitting that these issues are a problem for them, which is really distressing. But I think there's this kind of safety in numbers effect with everyone coming in at once to talk about it, which is sort of given some cover for nervous risk averse leaders. And also, I think in some cases, challenges around partnership working with students, partly because there's an easy bunch of students to get to. They're the ones in student societies, they're the ones that are on campus full time, they're the ones that are already quite invested in these issues and already kind of talking about them and wanting to do something. And then, of course, there's a sort of more dispersed group of students, whether they are kind of structurally dispersed, such as commuter groups, whether they're from a particular demographic that perhaps is culturally less keen able to talk about these issues that may not be being reached. So there's some really, really rich recommendations in the long report, and I absolutely commend it to anyone who's working in this area.
Yeah, so I mean, I come from this from a completely different perspective. I mean, I haven't worked in a university in 15 years, but I mean, it's clearly the case that there is, you know, a fair prevalence of harassment in the workplace. And I think it's sort of coming to light. I think people have known about it for many, many years, but it's sort of coming out into the open. I think that's got to be a good thing. I think you've got to shine a light on institutional practices or, you know, explicit or implicit facilitation of harassment. So I think I think everybody coming out at once and showing an evaluation of 108 or so programs, I think, is a good thing. I think the thing that concerned me the most was the potential institutional response or unwillingness to engage because of perceptions of negative publicity. I find that sort of shocking. I don't think there's any excuse for that. So and I think institutions, if you have a choice between, you know, essentially that's tacit facilitation of harassment, and, you know, I think the publicity associated with that and actual harassment is worse than any alternative.
What also struck me, I think, was the absolute necessity of using specialist staff in this area. So you really can't just sort of cobble together something. You've got to work with experts outside the university. You've got to have people on site who are trained, who are supported, and you've got to make sure that staff in general, not just a handful of kind of champions, are really up to speed with the issue. So I mean, when I spoke to women particularly for International Women's Day, working in this area and developing and delivering projects, one of the things that they said was that, you know, they would roll out training to, for example, academics and personal tutors and that sort of thing, but they initially, in one case, hadn't really thought about departmental administrators, but actually the departmental administrators were often a first point of contact for students, and they were interacting with students. And
yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important point. It costs money. There's one thing, it costs money, number one, but number two, I mean, you know, harassment sort of can happen at every single level of the organization. So you need, I mean, you know, you need someone like AC12 and Inspector Hastings. You need like a sort of a separate organization within the university to investigate and to sort of deal with harassment claims, because at the moment, I mean, it, you know, we see with the recent you know, incidents at University of Warwick, where you know, as the head of press or communications is involved in the sort of the panel to adjudicate whether the students are expelled from the university. And, you know, I mean, if that's a conflict of interest, you would assume.
I mean, it's really important that the prevalence of harassment and hate crime in society at large isn't quite rightly getting the publicity that, you know, to try and eliminate it. And the assault last week on the tube of Melania Gaimonat and her girlfriend, I think, has put this rightly in the spotlight. And I think there's now a lot more rightly visibility on some of the hate crime issues that the country faces. I myself have faced a couple of hate crime incidents in the last few years, and it's something that universities have to take incredibly seriously. And I'm really pleased that the OFS is making this a part of their work program, and universities absolutely have to mainstream this. And it's good to see the positive outputs from the case studies that they've got.
I mean, one thing I would sort of say, though, I think there's a real challenge in terms of the institutional structure of universities. And the fact is that they're very big, and they're sort of spread out. There's different departments and schools and layers within layers within the university. And it's actually hard to, you know, there's a real issue about identifying or having oversight of the problem unless significant resources are put in. So, I mean, I work in a small organization, and there's, you know, you've got a very good idea, and you have very, very tight monitoring of, you know, behaviors, essentially. So you know what's going on. But when at a university, I mean, there's such huge sprawling organizations potentially, you know, unless there's an appropriate commitment of resources, you know, and like a serious commitment of resources plus senior commitment, then, you know, this is going to just carry on and people are going to, you know, suffer very badly.
Next up, we talk about outward student mobility. But first, I want to tell you that on the 2nd of July, we'll be hosting Counting the Cost, an event to assess the impact of the Augar Review. Featuring an interview with Philip Augar, the day will give you a chance to hear from Team Wonky's experts, as well as leading voices from further and higher education. We will be demystifying and digesting all the numbers, such as the reduction in fee cap, the repayment threshold, and we'll look at the impact on the whole post-compulsory education system, whether that's lifelong learning, further and higher education, and how they all relate. And all of this in the context of a Conservative Party leadership race, an impending spending review and a demographic upswing on the horizon. To book your place and to see the full agenda, go to wonky.com/events. That's wonky.com/events. And we look forward to seeing you there.
University campuses can be surprising and unpredictable places. Students, staff and visitors often do the strangest things. Fortunately, our ever reliable security team are on hand to deal with every eventuality. For over a decade now, we've been compiling a comprehensive record of the bizarre, unfortunate, inexplicable, and just plain weird reports from campus security. Here's your chance to hear some of the most remarkable reports from the ever-expanding case notes of true crime on campus.
0600. Report of a heron eating a live goldfish from the Millennium Gardens. 10 a.m. Report that an envelope with £600 in it had been found in a book in the Hallwood Library. Security attended and collected the money from the library staff who found it. The student came to security later in the day to ask if the money had been handed in. Security were able to return the money to the very happy student. The student was given advice on looking after their money. The student also explained that this money was from his parents. 1900. The semi-final of the World Cup was screened with numbers attending in their low hundreds. No issues have been reported. Security measures are in place for the England game, which is being played this evening. Numbers and excitement are expected to be higher than last night. A call was also received by security from a Mr. G. Southgate, querying whether the registrar of the University of Nottingham was fully on board with the fact that it was coming home. Security assured him that the formal position of the university was that it was indeed coming home. Registrar to be alerted for follow-up. Just to note that the mystery of what exactly was expected to be coming home has yet to be satisfactorily resolved. And in any case, it ended up somewhere else after all.
Next up, international student mobility. So Universities UK International, or UUKI, have released their Gone International Rising Aspirations report this week. This is part of their Go International Standout campaign, which is designed to help the sector deliver on its national target for outward student mobility. So Greg, what were the key things which stood out for you in the report?
Yeah, it's a really important survey, and it's based on Delhi data from 16-17, the graduating cohort, basically. And it showed another modest rise in the proportion of the student population that are mobile, in other words, spent a week or more educated abroad. It's now up to just short of 8%, which is progress, but slow progress, I think it's fair to say. And we've got to remember we are way behind some of our European partners in terms of the proportion of students that are mobile. So, you know, though there's a modest rise, this is really not quite the global Britain aspiration that we need to be hitting. We should be, as the campaign states, hitting something like 13% or possibly more than that if we're really going to be serious international engaged students. So some good news and some bad news in the report on the whole. Good news in the sense that the class gap and the race gap in terms of the proportion of people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds who are mobile compared to those from higher socioeconomic backgrounds is narrowing slightly, but there is still a gap of 3-4% between less advantaged and more advantaged people, which is a depressing statistic. Although the BME gap for mobility is shrinking a little bit, there is still a 3% gap for the students who are black compared to students who are white in those who can or do access mobility. People talk often about the benefits that mobility has to students experiencing it. And it's clear, again, from the data in the report that those are real. So 92% of mobile graduates got a first or upper second class degree, whereas only 80% of non-mobile graduates do. Now, whether there's a causation there, I don't know. But I think, you know, there's a good indication that opportunities abroad really do stimulate people's academic achievement. And so it's really important to fix our gaze on hitting the target in the campaign of raising this from 8% effectively to 13% in only 2 years. So now how we can do this in the context of hard Brexit, goodness knows. If we're going to be crashing out in November, then of course we will probably leave Erasmus Plus the day after. So that would be a real concern. And, you know, we do want, strong commitment from the government, the UK government, to participate in Erasmus Plus, which they can do even as a non-member of the EU in the next round. So we do need to keep our eye on the international mobility ball. And this report is a very helpful sort of analysis and I think call to arms for the sector just to continue the work in this area and try to narrow the gaps, the participation gaps between the class gaps and the race gaps that I described.
I think there's a really interesting intersection between the gap and the advantage and disadvantage students and then also the subject gaps. So the sorts of subjects that people tend to go abroad less are things like social work, computer science, sports science, nursing. These are vocational professional sorts of courses. They also tend to have in some cases, you know, quite a lot of placement time and that sort of thing. And you might sort of argue that students studying these sorts of things have really enough on their plate without having to worry about going abroad. But they also, I think, in some cases tend to be, so nursing particularly, for example, is, you're going to get a high preponderance of mature students with less HE background in their family and stuff like that. And I think this is, one of the ways to tackle the disadvantage gap may be to actually look at the subject gap, because these subjects are not sort of necessarily constituted as being subjects in which a period abroad contributes to the overall subject, and also you've got professional statutory and regulatory bodies to contend with. So I think rather than if I was a university vice chancellor thinking about how to boost my mobility, I might start by thinking about the way that the subjects are constructed and talking to the regulators and the PSRBs about how nursing students, for example, can benefit from spending time abroad and looking at the way these things are done in other countries. And at Bedfordshire, there was a pilot program of a sort of short-term outward mobility for nurses, and it obviously went really well because it's a brilliant experience. So I think that could be a really interesting way into this challenge.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of really interesting things about this report. I mean, the impact of Brexit, any form of Brexit, not even hard Brexit, is going to be interesting. I mean, given that 50% of the outward mobility of the students went to the European Union, and it's only sort of 18 18% to the States and 7% to Australia, etc. So I think there are huge challenges ahead. But I thought the interesting thing about this report was the fact that it essentially mirrors the characteristics of the country. So if you look at, you know, where students are most likely to be outward mobile, Northern Ireland, a heavy Remain area, 12.1% of students were outwardly mobile. Scotland, heavy Remain, it's 10.4%. Wales, 6.5% or something. And England is 7.5% both leave. You know, but it's also, so I mean, geographically, it reflects the sort of thinking of the country in respect to just general mobility issues. But then I think there are real issues here about, you know, social class and entrenching social, socioeconomic factors. I mean, I think 15% of young people who were outwardly mobile were privately educated, compared to 7% for state schools. In terms of parental education, whether they had a degree, I think 10% had of parents, 10% of respondents had their parents had degrees, compared to 5% whose parents didn't have degrees. So, I mean, there really is this, you know, I'm not saying it's entrenching socioeconomic gaps, but it seems to be.
Yeah, I mean, it just, I think the task for government now really is to take international mobility more seriously in the negotiations and the plans for post-Brexit plans that they are assembling at the moment. And I hope the Treasury, when it, you know, looking at all the options for supporting post-Brexit contingencies, is looking at continuing paying for continued participation in Erasmus Plus. People talk about managed no deal. I'm not going to get into the the pros and cons of that in the Tory leadership debate. But if there is any scope for a managed no Brexit, I think that Erasmus and the international mobility programs ought to be pretty close to the top of that list to maintain our participation in those programs if we don't exit with a deal. So that's, I think, just a reminder to the government to how important this agenda is.
One last thing I've got is on this is that you know, a very high proportion of modern foreign language students were outwardly mobile, and you sort of expect to see that. I mean, I think I saw the figure of 93% of French students studying French were outwardly mobile, and that's great. But given the restrictions or the cuts in funding in sixth form education and secondary schools, so many secondary schools in the UK or in England are facing massive restrictions to their timetables. And you see the evisceration of modern foreign languages. So, you know, what's actually happening is that the pool of secondary school pupils that are going to come through to university with those or undertaking those qualifications or those course areas, course subject areas that sort of would naturally lead to outward mobility, they're going to get eviscerated. So I think, even though this report is great, I think this is sort of like, you know, peak outward mobility, and it's only going to go downhill from here, which is a real shame.
Now it's time for Yes, But Does It Correlate? You may have seen, if you are one of Wonky's daily subscribers, that our regular host of this, David Kernahan, got married this week. So here to set this week's correlation question is Wonky's associate editor, David Kernahan's son, Ben.
Hi, I'm Ben. My dad's away this week, so he's asked me to set some correlation questions for the podcast. First up, I was wondering whether the rise in teaching-only contracts and the rise in fixed-term academic staff has a statistical link. I'm worried that we're starting to see stratification in academia, and when I become an academic, I want to be able to do teaching and research because that's more fun. Teaching-only contracts and fixed-term contracts, yes, but does it correlate?
I'll go first. No. I have no idea why. I couldn't make any sense out of this, Ben, but I think no.
I think the case for it correlating relates to the, a sense that there's a sort of casualisation and that being put in a teaching-only contract is more likely to be a short-term contract, but you get fixed-term contracts in research more. So I think, no, it doesn't correlate.
Well, first of all, congratulations to David on the wedding. People have seen some of the Twitter photographs. They look fantastic. So good luck to him in his new stage of his life. But on answering the correlation, I don't think there'll be a correlation. I think teaching-only contracts probably are more related to universities taking a stricter line on the ref and submittable staff for the next ref. I think that would be the principal correlation there. So my answer would be no.
The answer is a yes. R squared is 0.52, a moderate correlation, which suggests that there is some link. The Russell Group uses more fixed-term contracts than average, but they also have more academic staff. Generally, it looks like the size of a university is the key to relationship. Data from 2017-18 HESA staff record, and where the data doesn't exist, I'm not using that catchphrase, okay?
And finally, the Conservative Party is searching for a new leader. Sam Jima, the former universities minister, has pulled out. So what do the other candidates think of higher education? We've been looking out for any HE policy which has entered into the race. So Debbie, what do we know at this stage?
Well, I should clarify for our listeners that at the time of recording, we're expecting, which is Thursday morning, we're expecting a number of the candidates to leave the race by about lunchtime today because of the new rules that say you have to get a certain number of votes to be allowed to enter the next round rather than kind of eliminating one at a time. So everything could have changed by the time people are listening to this. But I think it's fair to say the candidates are very unlikely to want to be drawn on some of the thornier issues in higher education. So I don't think we're going to see anybody coming out of the gate saying, I think we should cut tuition fees or increase funding to universities or you know, ban sports science or anything kind of like that. I think what we've seen so far is candidates sort of setting out broad agendas within which education, post-compulsory education, is may feature. And I think Sajid Javid's probably got the most coherent view perhaps of this area, and writing in the FT at the weekend, he talked about a sort of a new settlement on skills and about sort of building up Britain's capability to respond to technological change and that sort of thing. But Jeremy Hunt has also said that there should be interest rate cut on student loans as part of his kind of new deal for the youth, and Andrea Leadsom has said something about funding for apprenticeships and access to loans for skills, which sounded a little bit garbled, but she probably won't make it through the next round anyway.
Honestly, listen, I don't know where to start on this. I mean, I've heard about Jeremy Hunt and the interest rate cuts. I mean, it's just like, you know, retail politics, you know, give some sort of notional fop to, you know, hardworking families or hard pressed families or whatever it is. I think it's, I think they've got like zero engagement with the higher education sector at the moment. I mean, Boris, I heard, pitching for working class white votes by talking about sort of, you know, our great FE colleges and things like this. It's all political. There's no economics in it. You know, I would doubt whether any of them have read more than a paragraph of some hastily cobbled together note summarizing the Augur review. So I really haven't got a view on this at all. I think it's all pretty poor.
Yeah, I think the Augur panelists will be probably despairing at the extent and quality of the debate on post-compulsory education in the leadership contest thus far. It's very little indeed. Javid was, as Debbie correctly said, is the only one to really put any sort of indication of what he might do in government. He talks about personal learning accounts in the article in the FT on the weekend, which seems quite similar to what Augur proposes in terms of lifelong learning allowance, you know, sort of loan allowance. And a quite welcome, actually, quite welcome proposal in what he said on the weekend about broadening the apprenticeship levy to become a skills levy, to become a skills and education levy.
Yes, that's genuinely sensible proposal,
yeah,
isn't it?
Something that I've blogged about in the last few months as encouraging the government to think about. So I don't know what the CBI will think about that, but I think that that's genuinely got the potential to be an exciting proposal.
That's a really good point. I mean, there is this issue. I mean, we've been doing some work for Wonky and for Universities UK on costing up the Augur report. And we have a sort of section about winners and losers. And one of the winners from the Augur report are businesses. I mean, businesses, you know, even though they pay higher wages essentially on average to graduates, they still essentially achieve the same amount of benefit as the graduate does in terms of lifetime benefit from more highly productive workers. So, you know, employers are a winner. And the fact that they haven't been asked to contribute more extensively to the cost of higher education, I mean, that just staggers me that that's never happened.
And of course, that was out of scope for the Augur review, the apprenticeship levy, not the apprenticeship provision per se, but the nature of the levy wasn't within scope. So they weren't really allowed to examine that. So there is scope, you know, potentially looking forward to a new prime minister to think through from first principles what the levy should be funding. And
well, I mean, if we go back to history, what we need is, you know, essentially we need sort of a Labour manifesto to sort of suggest some levy of some description. And then, you know, the Tories will probably win the election and then implement some sort of watered-down version. I think it happened with the apprentice levy with Ed Miliband, and he was sort of accused of being a Marxist, you know, and then was introduced by Nick Bowles.
Well, there's an irony, isn't there, because Javid is advocating the skills levy, but also McDonnell himself in the last few months has talked about, not in definite terms, but talked about the attractions of broadening the apprenticeship levy out to wider purposes on education and skills. So you could have, but you know, left-wing Labour leadership and a potential Tory Prime Minister talking the same talk about this policy area. So, well, there we are.
I think there is a sort of a change. there is a kind of emerging consensus on post-compulsory education that I think Auger represents a version of, and it is around that sort of broader skills picture, and so it's less about kind of let's try and get as many people as we can into higher education, and more let's look at the kind of the full picture, and you'll get sort of left-wing flavors of that and right-wing flavors of that. But I also think the sector will benefit from higher education not being a kind of a differentiator in the Tory leadership debate, because goodness knows what people would pledge, you know, off the back of that hastily scribbled paragraph. What you want is for people to be setting out kind of broad visions and light on detail, because otherwise they'll be saying things they'll be tied to that could be not the right thing at all.
Yeah, quite. Be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, but the thing is, having broad visions and being light in detail, I mean, unfortunately, I think we've had that for sort of many, many years. And, you know, if leadership candidates are broad on aspiration, light in detail, you know, unfortunately, that never sort of seems to change. And that, you know, I mean, I think this is one of the problems we've had in the past.
I think what will be interesting is if there is a TV debate, I think, well, I mean, I will be watching avidly, it's because the people will be forced to, you know, people, the attempt will be to pin people down. So, one of the questions might be, what should tuition fees be? And it will be interesting to see how people avoid the question.
Yeah, and Boris may not turn up, of course, the leading candidate. Mm. So
that is about it for this week. Remember to delve deeper into anything we've discussed today. You can find the links in the show notes. And don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via iTunes or your favourite Android podcast directory. Or you can find the feed that you need on wonky.com/podcast. And if you fancy appearing as a guest on The Wonky Show, do drop us an email on team@wonky.com and we'll be in touch. So thanks to Gavin, to Greg and to Debbie and everyone at Team Wonky for making this happen. And until next week, stay electable.